Sometimes shows change in between London and New York or from revival to revival. However, few shows go through as frequent and as drastic changes as Chess, the concept album turned 1986 West End production, with lyrics by Tim Rice and music by Benny Andersson and Björn Ulvaeus of ABBA. The show, which is being adapted yet again next week at the Kennedy Center, follows the rivalry between two American and Soviet grand chess masters during the Cold War, as they compete for the world title and the love of another player, Florence. Intrigue, power ballads, and varying levels of character development ensue as the tournaments go on. My guest today is Monty Ashley, incomparable panelist and host of The Villain Edit. I hope you enjoy our conversation about chess. Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing good and well. I'm doing both of those.
I'm glad to hear it. So what are we talking about today?
We are talking about the musical Chess, lyrics by Tim Rice and Björn from ABBA, and music by Björn and Benny from ABBA.
That was such a nice formal introduction to the show, and like a level of professionalism that the show has not achieved before. But yeah, this is a very interesting musical, and you picked this immediately to talk about, and I want to know why. Why did you like this musical so much?
I like the musical Chess a lot. One reason is when it... All right. It's basically the most one-hit wonder of any musical. Like, if you know musicals, then you'll be like, oh, sure, A Little Night Music. That's the show with Send In the Clowns in it. But Chess is the musical with One Night in Bangkok in it. Not a lot of musicals have a huge breakout rock hit that most people don't even know is from a musical.
Yeah, One Night in Bangkok was literally the only thing I knew about Chess before you told me you wanted to talk about it.
So I came to Chess having bought the single of One Night in Bangkok, and on the B-side is a song called Murano, which is the first song in some versions of the show, and it's not very good. Like, you can't understand, or at least I can't understand, any of the words in it. And the music is just kind of...
Ta-da! What are you talking about? That's my favorite song.
Oh, okay. It's maybe my sixth or seventh favorite song. I really like the songs in Chess.
Yeah.
Once I realized it was a musical, I was really rooting for it, because this is the first show that Tim Rice did after he broke up with Andrew Lloyd Webber.
R.I.P.
Because, you know, they had done Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita. So as partners, they were on top of the world. And then Andrew Lloyd Webber went off and did Cats. And then after this, he did Phantom. So he's like, I don't need Tim Rice. And I was always thinking, oh, poor Tim Rice. And, you know, Tim hooked up with the guys from ABBA and did this kind of impenetrable show about a board game that they had to keep redoing, because I really like the songs, but the story makes no sense, and they've changed this story almost every time they show it. So I've always really rooted for it. I mean, luckily for Tim Rice, he also did lyrics for the movies Aladdin, after Howard Ashman died, and The Lion King. So he's also doing fine on Broadway now.
Yeah, I think that kind of worked out for him in the end. So how long ago did you get into Chess?
I bought the single One Night in Bangkok on 45.
Oh, okay.
I'm an old person. And I immediately started trying to hear the rest of the show. But back then, what you had to do was walk into a record store and say, do you have the musical Chess? And they would say, no. We have Brigadoon.
Oh, no.
But I kept trying, and eventually when it came to Broadway in 88, there was the U.S. cast album. And so I'd say by 88, I had heard the original concept album from London and the Broadway cast album, which I think the concept album is the black cover and the Broadway is the white cover, which is how I distinguish them in my head. So I knew the show by 88. And I've seen it live twice. In college, I drove from San Diego up to Los Angeles to see it with Philip Michaels. And at the time, I was thinking, great. So here's my theory on musicals. I'm just going to veer off into this suddenly. If you're seeing musicals live, what matters is the story and the characters, because you're watching a theatrical presentation. But if, like me, you live far away from Broadway, at the time I lived in San Diego, now I live in Seattle, most of the way you interact with musicals is through the cast album. So what you get is just a bunch of songs that may or may not connect. You could listen to Cats and think, that was great. I wonder how these stories connect. Then you watch the show and you discover, well, really, it's just mostly dancing, and each song just introduces a character who dances. So with Chess, I knew I liked the songs, but I wasn't clear from listening to the album what exactly was happening. I knew there was an American chess player and a Russian chess player and a woman who starts off the girlfriend of one and ends up the girlfriend of the other. But what else is going on? So then we watched it in Los Angeles and said, didn't really follow that. And since then, I've seen it a second time in Seattle, and I still, it was a different set of events with mostly the same songs, and you still don't really follow the plot, which I find fascinating, that something can be one of my favorite musicals based just on the cast album without the plot really mattering.
I am fascinated by this entire concept, this entire show. I also will say that I mentioned that the only thing I knew from this is One Night in Bangkok, but I actually didn't know it as a rock song or a pop song or anything. I knew it because when I was a kid, I had this 5-disc CD set of classic Broadway songs because my mom is a musical theater nerd and the apple did not fall far. And and I know like every single song that was on those sets because my siblings and I would just listen to them over and over again. So I like... all I knew was there was this song called One Night in Bangkok and it was from the musical Chess. And it was sung by the sibling of Anthony Stewart Head, who I knew from Buffy.
Right.
That was my whole context for it. So I just assumed it was a musical about Bangkok.
Well, that's an interesting thing because in the first version of Chess, what you have is one chess match in Budapest and then... plot happens, and then there's another chess match in Bangkok, and One Night in Bangkok kicks that off. But because that song is such a big hit, and it's all anyone knows from the show, if you look at how they've reworked the show over the years, One Night in Bangkok keeps getting earlier and earlier in the show, and sometimes it's all one chess match, and it's all in Bangkok, because it has to be in Bangkok now, because everyone wants it to be in Bangkok. Like, the show was being warped around that one song.
That is such a funny phenomena. So it is a musical about Bangkok now. My prediction came true.
It's a musical in Bangkok.
Well.
That song doesn't really do much for the show.
I know, it's also, yeah, it is a little bit of an anachronism.
Yeah, and Freddie, the American, is supposed to be a jerk, and I guess this is supposed, he's kind of based on Bobby Fischer, who was a famously jerky, well, more than jerky, American chess player. So this is just supposed to show, look how flashy and out there this guy is. But plenty of the other songs do that too. Like, for the purposes of the show, you don't need One Night in Bangkok. But for the purposes of getting people to come see the show, you 100% need it. Maybe multiple times.
See also celebrity casting on Broadway.
Yep.
Basically the same concept, except their celebrity is a song.
Yeah. But that's fine, because you can put a celebrity and you don't have to rewrite the script. As I speak, two different revivals of Chess are being planned. One in London and one in New York. And for both of them, people are busily rewriting the book, trying to make the show make sense and be interesting. The U.S. one is being written by Danny Strong, who was also on Buffy.
Yes, it's a whole weird chess Buffy thing. But that's a very interesting thing that's happening. And it was cool, too, because he did an interview and he was like, I loved this musical and now I'm working with my heroes to rewrite it. And I'm like, that's, first of all, really cool. And second of all, chess is the only musical you would have the opportunity to do that with, because what else is constantly being rewritten?
Right? Like, if they remake Oklahoma, you're just doing Oklahoma. When they brought Cats back after it was away for like 5 years, I don't think they changed the choreography. They didn't even keep Rum Tum Tugger being a rap song now, which they did in London.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't really know Cats very well, but I know of it very well.
I know Cats way too well. I saw Cats in its original cast on Broadway.
How was that?
For a, what was I guess, 13 or 14-year-old boy, it was amazing. They came out into the audience and climbed around. And we saw two shows on that trip to New York. We saw Cats and we saw Dreamgirls. And I don't remember anything about Dreamgirls, but I remember Cats pretty well. And I still have the souvenir program, which is how I know it was the original cast. Because I even have the little understudy slip for whoever was understudying that night.
Wow, that's cool. That's really funny, though, because my mom also has a story about going to see Cats as a teenager, and she didn't know what it was about, and they went. She went to see it. Yeah, yeah. Turns out, I think she just assumed there'd be a plot, and then literally she like went with her family, and her brother just turned to each other a couple songs in, and were like, "What is happening?" And it was downhill from there. They're not fans.
I was better prepared because before the show, I was actually a fan of T.S. Eliot's Book of Practical Cats. I had a cat named McCavity before there was a musical with a song called McCavity.
You're a cat's hipster.
I am a cat's hipster.
That's incredible.
I will defend Cats not super strongly. Like, it doesn't deserve the huge run it had, but you know, everyone says Follies is genius because it doesn't have a plot. If Cats weren't so popular, people would call it avant-garde because it's mostly choreography-driven instead of plot-driven.
Interesting theory. Probably correct.
Chess, however, tries to be plot-driven, but the plot isn't that interesting. There are three or four main characters in chess. You've got Freddy, the American. Anatoly, I think, the Russian, Florence, the woman, and then if you want to count him, the Arbiter. The Arbiter only has songs to pad things out. He doesn't have an arc of any sort. He just needs to come in and yell at people. But all of the characters are jerks that you don't root for.
Rough times.
Which is super fun for me when you're listening to songs, because one thing I really like about musicals is that villains get a chance to stand up and say, yes, I'm villainous, but here's why, and here's my point of view. And they get to express a point of view that you don't get a lot in other forms of media. So, like, in chess, Florence gets a great song called Nobody's Side, where she says things like, never make a promise or plan. Take a little love where you can. Nobody's on nobody's side. Which I really enjoy. But then when it's in the context of a musical where she's supposed to be, you know, torn between two lovers, and it's hard to feel a lot of sympathy for her when she's saying, never be the first to believe, never be the last to deceive. In most shows, that would make her the number one villain. And she'd be super fun that way, but she's not. She's like the center of the romance. So for storytelling purposes, it's a little awkward.
It feels to me like this bad side effect from starting from such a brilliant concept album. Because they came out with this concept album, it was really well received. And then it seems like, but when it came time to connect the dots, it just didn't happen.
Yes.
And then you end up with these problems.
Yep. They have a number of fun songs that just don't really coalesce into a story. So, in the television show Smash, one thing they are constantly shown doing is taking index cards and moving them to completely different parts of the show. Like, maybe this song that we have as the second to last number in the show should actually be in Act One. And that sounds crazy from a structural point of view, but that's the kind of thing they do with chess when they remount it, where they just say, we had this song about the origin of chess. What if we start with that instead of putting it in the middle of the show? Why not?
That does seem to be the basic game that gets played. Because there's two like really strongly different versions, which is the British version, and then they adapted it for Broadway. There's a table on Wikipedia. If you scroll to the bottom of the Wikipedia page, and it gives you the breakdown of major changes between major versions. Because there was also an Australian version that came out afterwards, and you're like, why? I haven't seen the show and I haven't experienced these versions, so you'd be able to speak on this better than I would. But some of these decisions, and I'm like, does that make it better, or does that just make it different?
Well, some of them make it better, some of them make it worse. Like, every change they make changes enough things that I'm not fully on board with any version. Like, in the original version, Florence comes from Budapest, I think. So, one of the things that the American Freddy does to make her hate Russians is remind her how horrible the Russians were to Hungary. And they have a song, 1959, Budapest is Falling, where he brings her back to that time. And then when they brought it to America, they said, we want an American Florence, so we're going to get rid of that whole thing. Well, that's crazy. What are you doing? That's a great song, and now you can't have it.
That was such an interesting decision to make Florence American, because it's not like Americans won't go to see shows that star British people.
No.
I don't know why they thought that was absolutely necessary.
I mean, that's 1988. That's well into Andrew Lloyd Webber, like, catsing Broadway up completely.
Wait, what is catsing as a verb?
Bringing British musicals that are more spectacle than story. There are a number of books about the American musical that refuse to admit that Cats or Phantom or Les Mis or Miss Saigon even happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because, those don't count as part of our tradition, even if they are the most successful things to take place on Broadway.
We might want to examine ourselves for a minute about that revelation, but yeah.
So you'd think with that happening, they would say, we could have a popular British singer. Let's see what Betty Buckley is doing. Is she still in Cats? Maybe she wants to be in chess. She probably doesn't.
She probably is smart about that.
Yeah. Well, I think Nobody's Side is a great song. You can really belt it out.
But yeah, but they don't go that way. And regard like of all these changes that they tried to make in the American version, it ended up doing really poorly on Broadway.
Yes, I don't know if it was a huge flop, but it was certainly a flop. It did not play for very long. People didn't like it because they didn't go full. They did go full spectacle on the staging, because a lot of what's happening in the show, once you get past all the songs, is two guys playing chess, which
is a tough sell.
On a Broadway stage with hundreds of people in the audience, you kind of got to zazz up a little. I have a copy of the script from Samuel French, and it has the script, the setting notes in the back, just in case you want to spend $4 million of your own money to replicate the experience. It's amazing. Giant moving set pieces. When I saw it in Los Angeles, it did not have all that stuff. But the Arbiter did do backflips.
Oh, well.
He was played by the Big Ragu from the guy who played Carmine Raguso on Laverne and Shirley.
I'm sorry, I didn't know any of those words.
That's fine.
Well, the person playing the Arbiter now is Bryce Pinkham.
I don't know any of those words.
Yeah. Well, he was the star of A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Oh, okay.
Which he was very... I actually got to see him because he came back to do the last few weeks of the show, which is when I saw it. And he was very good. And so he... I think he played the Arbiter in one version, and he's coming back for the one that's going up just in a couple weeks. Yep. And while I'm at this, I just want to shout out Karen Olivo, who's playing Florence, and I'm very excited about. She was one of the stars of In the Heights and has been in Hamilton and is great.
So probably not Hungarian again then.
Yeah, so I was looking up the casting, and I am not familiar with the characters playing our two grandmasters, but it's Rao Esparza and Raman Karamlu, which I'm sure I just butchered both of their names. But they are not from our traditional ideas of our white American and our Russian chess player. So it seems like there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with casting.
Raul Esparza, I know him. He's great.
I think that we have different repertoires of Broadway actors in our minds, which would make sense.
Just reading off his Wikipedia, he was Riff Raff in the revival of the Rocky Horror Show, and he played the role of Caractacus Potts in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I hear was terrible.
Rough. But that's cool, though. Yeah, so I don't know if it's going to be televised or not. I think it just sounds like it's going to be televised. I haven't actually seen that anywhere.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of an in-town tryout as opposed to an out-of-town tryout,
mm-hmm.
where if it goes really, really well and there's an open theater, maybe we'll take it to a legitimate theater. Maybe we won't.
Yeah, I kind of hope it does well. Maybe they will finally manage to fix the book and this will be the one.
I mean, like I say, there's a lot of songs I really like in this show. I just wish they could connect them somehow. But when I'm listening to the album, I don't have to worry about that.
That's also true. I was listening to the album today for the first time, and...
Which one?
The concept album.
Okay.
With the original London cast. Right. It's actually, on Spotify, it's Chess, in parentheses, the original recording /remastered/deluxe edition.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I actually prefer most of the versions on the Broadway cast album, even of One Night in Bangkok, because they pronounce it cerebral instead of cerebral.
Interesting. I really like Murray Head. I don't know why. This is the only thing I've experienced him through, but it's also really great because the first song on this version of the album is Murano, and it's like three songs put together, and it starts out in this fairly traditionally sounding musical theater-y song with an ensemble, and then Murray Head comes in and suddenly it's a rock song.
Yeah. That's them establishing, like, this is a rock musical, which a lot of shows have claimed to be rock musicals. Very few have actually had a hit single come out of it. Like, this and Hair are the only ones that actually come to mind.
It really transcended just that one bit, but I can really see how this has become a bit of a cult favorite.
Oh, exactly, because, you know, if you want to be a Broadway hipster, you got to have a show where you're like, this show, it had flaws, but I can see past them and understand its hidden greatness, and maybe someday the rest of you will understand what I already know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then on the non-cynical side of that as well, which I agree with the cynical side, but on the non-cynical side, there's also everything that you were talking about of like being able to appreciate this so fully for just the cast album, which makes it accessible to a lot more people, and in fact, perhaps makes it even like more enjoyed by people who haven't seen it.
Sure. Like, certainly some of the songs are more fun if you're not trying to follow the, at times, impenetrable plot about the Russians trying to convince Anatoly to do this while Freddy is doing this and arguing with his handlers, and Florence can't decide if she likes Freddy. She shouldn't. He is clearly a jerk. Like, when he enters in the middle of Murano with that electric guitar, you can pretty much immediately tell, oh, I don't want him to be my boyfriend. That's gonna go very poorly. This is a rock star chess player.
Oh, it is. It's just the whole convention of the rock star and the chess grandmaster thing at the same time is just funny.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of what happens in chess depending on when it happens, actually happened in real chess games. Because there was a time when the Cold War was very serious and U.S. and Russia hated each other and also had the top chess players. So every chess championship was the Cold War in miniature. And Kasparov and Fischer would battle it out. And then all sorts of stupid stuff would happen, like somebody would be accused of cheating for getting yogurt during a match. Because what if that's a signal? What if they've set it up? So tapioca means watch your knight, but vanilla pudding means you should castle soon. And they had these really, really serious arguments about it, which is what this show is all sort of based on. And it's very hard to take seriously now.
I did see that mentioned in one of the plot descriptions that, like, the Russian gets yogurt and the American gets mad. And I was like, excuse me?
That happened.
Wow. That's a thing. So interesting. Oh, this is such a beautiful mess. I just, like, this is... I have so many feelings about this musical now. I just cannot wait to experience a version of it on stage now.
I hope it's good this time.
That's the dream. But yeah, maybe our Danny Strong version will come through and we'll have another Broadway revival. Or has it already had a revival?
Oh, yeah.
Of course it has.
If you go up to the top of the Wikipedia page, there are, it looks like, 10 or 11 productions listed. The West End, there's Broadway, U.S. Tour, U.K. Tour, U.K. Tour again. Regional productions all over the place. This is a show that encourages regional productions because I think they're hoping somebody will solve it.
It's all an experimental lab, really.
Yeah.
There's also been a lot of concert versions of it, which makes sense.
Yep. That way you can just have somebody come out and sing Pity the Child, which is a great song about how Freddie's parents didn't appreciate him and he grew up alone, so he dove into chess, but he doesn't care because now he's a success. And then it ends with him basically saying he's never contacted them in case they don't even remember who he is. Which I just find heartbreaking.
There's a lot of really sad stuff in this show.
It's a very pessimistic show. Like, it usually kicks off now with the history of chess, which asserts right up front, each game of chess means there's one less variation left to get through. Each game got through means one or two less mistakes remain to be made. Which, man, is that all we're doing? Is just checking off mistakes?
Pretty much, I guess.
Come on, chess, lighten up.
Chess is a very serious game and a very serious musical.
Oh, it's very serious.
It is. It's such an interesting representation of the Cold War as well. I mean, especially, like, they chose chess as this conduit because, like, as you said, that it really was this representation of the relationship in that time. But now it takes on an interesting context in 2018 when we're returning to have a weird relationship with Russia again in different ways.
Yeah. And now humans playing chess is cute because computers are way better than us.
Oh, man. Give me a version of chess where the Russian is an AI.
That takes away some of his songs, I would think.
We can workshop this. I'm gonna email Danny Strong and see what he thinks.
So I would say I love this show because it's fascinatingly flawed. It's got these at least five or six songs I love to death. But there's enough other weirdness about it that if it plays near me, I want to see it. Not to see a brilliant story, how they tackled it, but I want to see how somebody interprets it in a way. I want to see what successes and what failures each new production brings to it.
When you go to see productions of it, do they include, like, oh, this is based on the British version, but these are the changes, or do you just, go in and see what you see?
You go in and see what you see. You try to read the little plot summary in the playbill, but I don't know, maybe you're different. I can never retain those even with a sensible show. And in this one, imagine reading one of these plot synopses for 10 minutes and then the lights go down and then people are singing at you.
Yeah. Don't imagine that's the most conducive environment to remembering a complicated plot. I just keep envisioning budget versions of the staging of this production.
It doesn't need anything big.
I feel it lends itself so easily to like a fairly minimalist route, but it's also there's like, as you saw in the Broadway version, so many possibilities to just go completely huge in terms of technology and effects and spicing up the chess and everything.
Yeah, when One Night in Bangkok hits, you want lasers and fog machines and video screens. The original version was very into their video screens, which in 1988 was amazing, I guess.
Man, I love 80s productions into video screens. So charming.
That's how you know it's high tech. This is a high tech musical.
I do want to back up and talk a sec for about the production of this again, because I am fascinated by how this particular team got brought together. We talked about a little in the beginning of like Tim Rice's, how he got started on this, but these are the songwriters from ABBA. And this is like way pre Mamma Mia, which is fascinating to me.
Well, pre the show Mamma Mia, after the song Mamma Mia.
Oh, yes. Important clarification. This is pre the show Mamma Mia by like 15 years or so. So this was really like their first serious foray into like, let's write songs for musical theater.
Yeah.
And then they would, this is a tidbit that I thought was really interesting, is they would write the music and Tim Rice would share like, this is what I want this feeling to be, and they would write the music, but they would fill in lyrics as placeholders, and some of them were just so good that like a bunch of them ended up being part of the final show as well.
Yeah, and I haven't read this for sure, but it's hard not to think that maybe Tim Rice wanted to be the one in charge of this show after having worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber on a few.
That seems like a reasonable assumption.
He's written an autobiography, and I really need to read it.
Oh, yeah? Ooh, that'd be interesting. I just get the vibe that, like, if I ever worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber, I feel like I would very much crave being in charge of something after that.
Right. Because, and especially after Cats came out, there was backlash against Cats, which continues, but there was also a sort of feeling that, oh, we see, Andrew Lloyd Webber was the genius. He makes these wonderful melodies, or, you know, borrows these wonderful melodies from elsewhere, depending on how you look at it. Tim was just filling in words. So I can imagine him wanting to have his own big splash.
There was a line when I was reading this that made me sad and annoyed when Tim Rice is talking about how he really, by all accounts, like, he really loves chess, and he thought it was a really great thing, and he's like pretty sad that it wasn't as successful as he wanted it to be, and people didn't like it as much as he wanted it to be. I think he really wanted it to be his Cats. But then he also says basically, like, it's just above you. Like, you all just don't get it. I'm like, yeah. Oh damn, okay.
I'm gonna say something bold here.
Okay.
A lot of Stephen Sondheim shows were not successful on Broadway, and it's because people didn't get them. So just because it wasn't popular doesn't mean people did get it. I think the reason chess has never really hit is mostly that there's no character anybody likes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Florence has two big songs, Nobody's Side, which is a fantastic villain song if you just read the lyrics, and Someone Else's Story, where she's just saying, this is awful, I wish I weren't here. Freddy is a huge jerk. He has the hit song, One Night in Bangkok, but also Pity the Child, where he's kind of being a huge jerk to his own child self and also his parents. Anatoly kind of doesn't really stand out in any of his songs to me. Freddy also has a song that was added in the Broadway version called No Contest, where he and his handler are arguing. The handler is saying, basically, don't forget you've got your country behind you. And Freddie says, I don't need my country behind me. I'm fantastic, baby.
Oh, I'm so uncomfortable.
And that leaves what? The Arbiter? The Arbiter isn't even a character.
I feel like the basic structure of how the plot is laid out makes it easiest if you were going to go in and like pick this as your angle to try to fix it, to make Anatoly the hero, and just make him more like interesting and memorable in general, and then make him a more sympathetic character. Because I mean, he like you would have to do a lot of work on Freddy to make him particularly likable.
Yeah, like, well, pity the child does some work to give you. To give him some sympathy, but it usually happens really late in the show. And Anatoly is more sympathetic than Freddy, but Florence is usually just cast as leaving Freddy and ending up with Anatoly because I gotta go out with somebody and there's only one other guy in the show, which doesn't put her in the best light either.
Yeah, that's whole thing is...
And really, you never care that much about who wins any of the chess games, which the musical is called chess.
But the chess is a metaphor.
But you're not invested in the metaphor. And you should be. Lots of shows are about metaphors, but you have to take the metaphor seriously on their level.
Yeah, I want this to be built more as like a sports movie where, you know, you're like rooting for the characters and then you care so deeply about who wins and... all this stuff. Like, Bring It On did this way better than chess does.
Right. Or let me give an example from a universally beloved masterpiece. The moral of A Chorus Line is that you have ignored the individual people in the chorus line and the individuals don't matter. But by the end of the show, you are incredibly invested in which of them get parts. Chess fails to invest you in who wins the chess game. In fact, a lot of times in Act 1, Freddy just concedes and walks out.
I think that the show fails to place adequate weight on why it matters who wins.
Right. We don't have the Cold War anymore.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since we did. It was before I was born. You really do need to do more than say, it's America versus Russia, for the audience to immediately start getting up and booing people.
What's also interesting is in the original British version, Freddy does go through somewhat of a redemption arc, and he's supposedly, like, a nice person, or a nicer person, by the end of it. And they removed that in the American version. They were like, nah, still a jerk.
Oh, but No Contest is such a great song.
Is it?
Yes,
it is. Okay, I haven't actually heard that one, so I don't know.
It's got a part I love dearly that immediately turns into an awful part.
Okay.
I'm saving it for later when you ask me what my favorite line from the show is.
Okay. I'm excited to hear it.
You know, Tim Rice can write good lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
And the guys from ABBA can write catchy tunes. There's no question about that. It's just kind of weird that a musical made out of essentially random ABBA songs has a much better plot than a show where they were writing to a plot.
They really needed to hire a book writer.
They did.
They really needed to hire a better book writer.
Yep.
It is. I also, while I was thinking about chess, then of course I was thinking about Mamma Mia. And then I went and watched the trailer for Mamma Mia 2 again. And like, I don't know how, like, again, this story of random ABBA songs. I love Mamma Mia. And then we have this sequel that's like completely after the fact, and I'm still so hyped for it. I believe in it so strongly.
I have one nice thing to say about the Mamma Mia sequel and one mean thing to say.
Okay.
The nice thing is that I think its title, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, is perfect.
Yes.
There's no better title for a Mamma Mia sequel. The mean thing I will say is that the trailer ends with a joke that is stolen directly out of Sports Night.
Wait, what is it?
You weren't supposed to tell anybody. I only told X. Well, I only told Y. I told many, many people.
Oh, it's such a good joke, though.
Yeah, I really liked it in Sports Night. Joshua Molina sold the heck out of it. Mm. But I saw it a long time ago. Other than that, I have no opinion on Mamma Mia.
That's fine. I don't think you're required to.
Well, like I said earlier... because of where I live, the primary way I interact with musicals is through cast albums.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I going to listen to the cast album of Mamma Mia? I can just listen to ABBA doing those songs. If you're just listening to the songs, it's not the show at all, is it?
I'll tell you, though, the Mamma Mia movie came out when I was pretty young, and that was my first exposure to most of those songs. And I know the Mamma Mia versions, and also embarrassingly, like, the movie Mamma Mia version so well that the other day I heard an ABBA song, like, someone's playing, and I was like, this is weird. And then I was like, oh, it's the original version.
That's fair.
But yeah, it is nice to see that despite Chess, I mean, it was a success in the UK. It was did relatively well. It just happened to, and again, flop is a strong word, because it was doing reasonably well. It was just expensive to produce, and they could see that, like, it wasn't going to have long-term success, and so I think it ended a little faster than it technically had to, but they were like, this isn't gonna work.
Yeah, it's hard to know what flop means on Broadway, because even shows that look like they were successful can lose people a whole ton of money. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I don't know why I have to care about whether it was profitable or not, so I guess I just look at how long it ran.
Yeah, as non-Broadway producers, we have limited metrics.
Yeah. Like, was that Spider-Man musical a flop? It did run, like, almost a whole year.
Yeah. Ran way longer than Chess, but...
Yeah.
Ugh, yikes, Spider-Man. One day someone will do Spider-Man on this podcast, and I can't wait.
I saw Spider-Man on Broadway, so I have things to say about it.
Oh my gosh.
And it is relevant to this, because it also has a rock band doing the songs. But the way U2 did the songs, or I guess it wasn't U2, it was just Bono and The Edge, they just wrote songs and mailed them in, and weren't collaborative at all, it sounds like. Oof. So the songs just kind of come out of nowhere and happen.
I really don't know a whole lot about Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, but I did read that Imagine Dragons originally wrote Radioactive as a song for that musical, and then ended up just releasing it as a single, and it did super well. And it makes so much more sense now. It's Radioactive.
Yeah. There is a book written by the guy that wrote, I think, the book for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, and it is amazing. Because, first of all, you know, famously troubled production, lots of crazy stuff happened. Julie Taymor, wild ideas, doesn't, it sounds to me, want actually to do a Spider-Man musical. Like, the first half of the book, there's a lot of high-minded, we're not doing comic books, we're doing myths. And that's why they were going to have Arachne, the Greek goddess, and she wasn't a goddess, actually, but she is now. As a character, and they're going to have the geek chorus commenting on everything.
Yeah.
And then nobody liked any of that. So Julie Taymor got forced out by this guy who she kind of brought into the whole project. So it's a fascinating book, and it really makes the writer the bad guy, or a bad guy. He does not know how bad he comes off in his own book.
Uh-oh.
Everybody comes off bad. But having said all that, like I say, I saw that show on Broadway. I wasn't that into it, but there was a 10-year-old kid across the aisle from me, just stars in his eyes, loved every second that was happening.
That's adorable.
And there's nothing wrong with a Broadway musical that kids love. I hear this SpongeBob musical is fantastic.
I've heard really good things about the SpongeBob musical. I do kind of want to see it now.
Right?
Also, to bring this full circle, Julie Taymor directed The Lion King, which Tim Rice wrote for, so everyone is connected.
Right, so Tim Rice eventually got his Cats on Broadway. That thing's going to run forever.
And it's literally Cats. Sorry.
Nice!
I just got excited about that.
Good one. I mean, he obviously has less ownership of it, but man, that is a good show.
And it will run until we were all dead.
Oh, yeah. And even the touring versions, like, you know, I've seen the movie, I am a sophisticate, you sit down, and then the music starts, and the animals come down the stage, tears everywhere.
Oh, I've never actually seen it.
Oh my god.
Okay. I will see it. The thing is, like, because I know it's going to be on Broadway forever, so whenever I have the opportunity to see a show that's not the first one I pick, because I'm like, I can always see that next time.
Absolutely, but the staging of The Lion King is just amazing.
I will definitely definitely see it at some point.
Yeah, you've got time. I'm sure it's not selling out anymore. There are half price tickets available somewhere.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's the other thing is like, the thing that's funny is it's like the Lion King of Phantom of the Opera will run forever, but they also always have half price tickets available. It's an interesting dichotomy. Yeah.
Well, they can't stop running Phantom ever.
It's just past its 30-year anniversary. Just ridiculous. So I think my concluding thoughts on chess before we get to the lightning round, I feel a little bad for the production team and the writing team, although they clearly loved this and it didn't work out as much as they wanted it to, but they also all had other projects that ended up being much more successful, so they're all fine.
There's worse things to be than Tim Rice and the guys from ABBA, right?
Yeah, they're fine. And I'm also completely fascinated by it, and I think I'm going to keep listening to this album because I really like it.
Yeah, right on! It's a fascinatingly flawed show.
Excellent. Well, I've got another one to listen to now, because that's what I need, more musicals.
Yay!
All right, are you ready for the lightning round?
Yes.
What is your favorite song?
Nobody's Side. I brought it up a couple times. I really like a song where somebody just comes out and says in no uncertain terms, the way to get by in this life is to deceive and don't trust anybody. They're all jerks and you have to be a bigger jerk than them.
And what's your favorite line?
My favorite line is from the song No Contest that isn't in the concept album. It's when Freddie and his handler are arguing. They have come to an agreement at the end of the song that Freddie's the best, baby. The line is, no contest, baby, barely any point in playing when it's just delaying what we both already know. No contest, baby, barely any point in playing when it's just delaying what we both already know. Sadly, the next line, which is the last line of the song, I hate, and it's, he lost it a woman and a half ago. Which is just terrible.
Oh, boy.
For one thing, we don't even know that. There's only one woman in the show. Guys, come on.
Well, Tim Rice giveth and Tim Rice taketh away. Who would you recommend go see this show?
People who don't want to get invested in the romance. Like, this is the opposite show from, let's say, Les Miserables. When Eponine dies, tears. When Fantine dies, tears. When Gavroche dies, it's not so bad. But I guess...
Wow.
I do not care for Gavroche's song. He's a little too cockney for me.
Okay. That's a different podcast.
If anyone died in this musical, like if at the end of Act 2, suddenly, even if Florence died... You'd go, well, that's the end of her story, I guess.
And moving on. Yep. If you could play a character in this show, who would you want to play?
The Arbiter.
Ooh, interesting.
The Arbiter doesn't have to get involved in any of the foolishness, but he gets to come in and rule on people. And he has a great, mostly nonsensical song that's full of lines like, from square one, I'm watching all 64. I like a role that's just coming in for the high points, like a King Herod. Just, hi, everybody. Okay, I'm done. Bye. And that's kind of what the Arbiter gets to do. He does not do a very good job. In my opinion, more arbitration is needed to keep these games under control.
It's probably a good point. And finally, if you could combine this show with any other one, which would you pick?
The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Okay.
For one thing, that show also has great evil songs like The Middle of the Riddle and Madame Guillotine. But also that show has much bigger stakes that it establishes. You know, we have to fight because these things are happening. We have to save people because people's heads are being cut off. So I'd like to take the stakes of the Scarlet Pimpernel, which was originally done around the same time as chess, and somehow transplant chess into it, even though they're set at wildly different times.
I really like that. I like that idea. And that is our whole conversation on chess. It is a weird, beautiful thing.
Yay!
Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening today. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you'd like, you can also leave us a review in Apple Podcast or recommend us in Overcast. Until next time, have a good week and try not to panic about any yogurt appearances.